huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means taking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive but also profitable.
When you use your reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here, and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. I think you're going to love this episode, where I was very fortunate to interview Nick English, who, along with his brother Giles, co-founded the award-winning British luxury watch brand Bremont. Now, they only founded in 2002, so to become a leading watch brand in the world and pretty much the only British luxury watch brand in, what, less than 16 years, I can't tell you how phenomenal that is, because it's such a mature industry where every luxury famous watch brand is 100-odd and more years old, gone through families and families of generations and history, and then many of the big global watch brands owned by huge groups of companies, which Nick talks about in the interview. So it's amazing what they've done. They've both been very much inspired by their father, who was a pilot and an aeronautical engineer. And as the brothers, the English brothers, were growing up, always buying old watches, taking them apart, putting them back together, just like they were with aircraft. It was very much in their blood. And I know that to this day, Nick and Giles' father still lives through the brand with them, because unfortunately in 1995, Nick was flying an aircraft. His father was in the aircraft. It crashed. His father died. And Nick, he had 30 bone breakages and spent months and months and months recovering. And we go into that in a little bit. I think you can really feel the history, the heritage, the disruption, the passion through the brand. They've won all sorts of awards. I interview them at their HQ in Mayfair. Very British. Just an amazing interview and experience, which I think you'll love. So, you know I'm passionate about watches. You don't need to be passionate about watches. You just need to be passionate about business and entrepreneurship and delivering value and excitement and heritage to enjoy this interview with Nick English, co-founder of Bremont Watches. Nick, thanks for doing the podcast.
Rob, absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming in here.
I'm really excited, and I'll tell you why. Because there aren't many or any other high-end watch brands that are British. And having been in here and looked around your boutique, it feels so British.
Yeah, I suppose most watch boutiques, I suppose if you're used to them, they're probably more Swiss, aren't they? Mm. So it's certainly a slightly different angle on it, for sure.
Yeah, and did you not think, you know, the watch world is dominated by the, you know, the Swiss and the big brands at 200 years old or something like that? You know, was it not a bit risky to go and set up a disruptive boutique-y watch brand?
Disruptive
that's my take on them.
For sure. You know, no, it is definitely littered with risk. There's no doubts about it. There's definitely a huge part of what we've done has involved a lot of risk. But at the same time, you know, there's this amazing history of British watchmaking. You forget the turn of last century, 60% of the world's watches were made in this on British shores, which is quite phenomenal. You go back to John Harrison and his ship's chronometer, and you take 60% of any watch, mechanical watch we wear today, it doesn't matter what brand it is, 60-70% of that innovation came from UK as well, in terms of auto-winding, second-hand, all these different things, very interesting technological advances came from Brit inventor, you know, horological experts. So there is that history there. Rolex founded in Clerkenwell in 1905, whatever it was.
Right,
so there's,
yeah.
It is there, and what we're passionate about at Bremel is very much the engineering aspect, and I think that's what drives us forward. And obviously, this passion to try and bring a watchmaking map to the UK.
And has it been hard trying to position an exclusive brand, a luxury brand, a high-end brand, with all of the great established brands that are out there?
Do you know?
Well, have you not even tried to do that?
No, do you know, I don't think we did. Yeah. I don't think we started saying we've got to position ourselves like this. I think what we wanted to do is, if you look at what making watches is a tricky business. You've got to be an engineering company. So if you come to one of our facilities, you'll see a bar of metal going in and watch parts coming out, watch cases, watch movement parts. That in itself is a business. You know, that's not easy. Then you've got to obviously assemble them, design them. You've got to retail them. So it's quite a complex business. And I think when you start out, we felt very much that the brand wasn't going to be fashion. It was going to be based around engineering. It's going to be based around the product itself in terms of something which had longevity, something you could pick up in 20, 30 years' time and say, actually, that still looks nice.
Yeah.
And by the time you've designed all that, you've put it together, you're not actually, there is a cost base intrinsically associated with that, to make a product of this ilk. And we wanted any good watchmaker, well-trained watchmaker, to pull apart a Bremel in the years to come and say, actually, that's a beautifully made watch.
Yeah.
And I think if you put that sort of man of craftsmanship and work into it, it's going to have a level of price point anyway. You can't avoid that. And so by default, you're entering that market space. And the rest, you just got to your fingers crossed and hope that it works, really. Mm.
And do you intentionally limit the supply to try and maintain the exclusivity, or is that just something that's forced upon you because you can't make 1.1 million watches like Rolex can?
Well, that's the point. You can't. And, it takes a long time to train up various watchmakers. You're looking at probably, 90% of the people who work for Bremel, the watchmaking front, have been trained by us.
Yeah.
Because you can't sort of go and ring a few up in the UK and pluck them out of nowhere. There is,
I guess the best watchmakers in the world, there must not be very many of them, and most of them are in Switzerland. Would that be fair?
No. Switzerland, yeah. Germany, countries like this. And so what we very much had to do is bring these guys on board and train them up through apprentice schemes. And
that's very much a long-term play, isn't it?
Well, it is. So we have to, we're looking 20, 30 years down the line, not just tomorrow. And it takes time. So even if we wanted to make 500,000 watches a year tomorrow, we couldn't. You're restricted by one, mostly resource in terms of skill set.
Yeah. And so this training of people and bringing your values through, have you found that a challenge?
We've got some very good people.
Yeah.
So we have watchmakers with a lot of experience. Mm. So if you take a more, I suppose there's a handful of watchmakers at Bremel who've got average of 20, 30 years experience. Mm. A lot of them, some set up the British School of Watchmaking. They come from brands like Breguet, Patek, Amiga. There's some great skill set. We've got one of the...
How did you get them? Did you go on a massive headhunting spree?
I think there's a genuine passion to try and bring back watchmaking in the UK. And I think the opportunity to work for a company, obviously the first one or two when you're starting off is based on relationships and you're getting on well with these guys. So I'll take a punt and come work with you.
Yeah.
But after a very short period of time, you start pulling off more and more, or bringing in more and more interesting people who actually come to you. And that's a really humbling thing to have happen, but it is. And they're kind of on the same journey. Everyone's sort of living and breathing the same mission, which is great.
Yeah. In the early days, did you get your hands dirty, you and your brother and Giles, and making?
Well, we could put a watch together, but that's about as far as go. We design all the watches.
Yeah.
So we're engineers background-wise. And, before Bremel, we were running a business restoring historic aircraft. That whole love of all things mechanical is in our blood from a very early age. So the curiosity of putting these things and taking them apart, I think, as with so many guys, was there. Yeah. And we have a very, very good understanding, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it of how they all works. Mm. But no, we're not trained watchmakers.
No.
It takes years and years and years. And I don't think you can do both.
Yeah.
Run a business like this and be a full-time watchmaker or have that skill set. It's very particular discipline.
Sure. And how has your role changed from when you started? Because I guess you must, you said, in a business, there's a lot of different facets to running a business, isn't
there? Well, there is. I mean, as I was saying earlier on, it is a complex business. And when we went to Switzerland, so we set up the business, first of all, in 2002, and we literally went with a blank sheet of canvas. And we set up a little workshop in Bienne, in Switzerland, and we had four people. And Giles and I had some contacts from the watch industry beforehand, and we told our wives it'd take a year and a half to make our first watch, and 5 years later, we still hadn't launched it. So it took a long, long time. But in that five-year period, we learned so, so much. Because you have to. Yeah. You know, you're mortgaging your house for the fifth time, whatever it is, without your wife knowing.
Good job you're living near London.
Yeah.
Price is going up.
No, well, actually, back then, I was living in France, so that was a fat lot of good.
Yeah.
But you're getting fully immersed, and you understand how the Swiss watch industry works. It's very horizontally integrated, so you'll have one guy doing one thing. It might be gaskets or crystals or cases or hands, and you learn a huge amount. And they are willing to help you. You know, if you find the right guys, and there are a lot of nice guys out there, they're willing to certainly help you along your way. But and then by doing that, we learnt enough to understand the industry, and then eventually bring as much as we've back to the UK as we have done today. Mm. So it's fascinating. But so to begin with, you're immersed in everything.
Yeah.
And as we're still immersed in a lot now, but you've got a very, very good management team below us, which we're very lucky with.
So you're not in the boutique as much?
I know, we're in here for, we have some great events in here. We have this Bremer Adventurers Club, once a month where people come along, and we have one of our ambassadors talking and standing on that box there, talking about, rowing across wherever or traipsing across the Antarctic or wherever whatever they've done. And so this boutique is a great sort of meeting place. Mm. And we have four or five of these around the world now.
Yeah.
But you can't be, I think, for example, on the sales front, you can't go off and see every retailer every week like you used to in the past. So it's impossible.
But you've done great. I mean, you've only been doing this 15 years.
But can you see the bags in the eyes? It feels like 50.
Still
like
smiling, 50. Though. But, the amount of time it takes to make a great watch, it's amazing how fast you've grown.
Yeah, it probably takes to get all the parts together. And, we're not just, we're trying to do as much as we can in the UK.
Yeah.
So it's not just about buying a case. It's about making that case. So you're buying a rod of steel, which is a huge, huge undertaking to take that to, human hair is what, 50, 60 microns, and we're machining cases and movement parts to 50, 60 microns.
Wow.
I mean, sorry, it's sort of 3 or 4 microns, sorry.
Right, yeah.
Which is huge, minute. So it's, it's not an easy business, that's for sure.
How many watches do you produce a year? Is that figures that you publish?
We don't, but we're roughly 10,000 or so. So, but we only make chronometers, so in the top handful of chronometer producers in the world.
Yeah.
We only, obviously, mechanical watches.
Yeah.
And out of that selection of watches, a huge amount's, is done by ourselves.
So. Yeah. So I often have a little quick fire at the end, and I'm going to bring one of those questions forward because you said about mechanical watches. What do you think about smart watches? Would you swap your Bremont for an Apple iWatch?
I think they definitely have a place. I think
you're being very diplomatic.
No. I think it's just something that's so, so different. I mean, it's a piece of technology.
Mm.
So, I mean, you were in here a second ago. A big chunk of our business is military.
Yeah. Yeah, military, fascinating conversation.
Military guys, they'll buy a watch because it's an heirloom.
Yeah.
They'll be flying with this thing and often in conflict. It's then something which they can hand down to future generations.
Yeah.
Their kids, and they might buy 2 or 3 of them because they have 2 or 3 kids.
Yeah.
You're not going to do that with a smartwatch.
No.
It's defunct in a year. You're going to bin it, and you're going to get something else.
Yeah.
And it has incredibly interesting health benefits. It has, as these Fitbits do. And but there are places for both. You see a lot of guys now wearing a lovely watch like yours, but also a Fitbit on the other hand.
Yeah.
And then, or these smart straps. There are different ways of doing it. But it's not a piece of technology or a machine that you're going to relish in 30 years' time and hand down. And I think that's where the difference is. And, there's 86,400 seconds in a day. And when you hold it, you've got a mechanical watch on your wrist like this, and it's a minor miracle, if you think about it. The most accurate mechanical devices on the planet. And you'd think it'd be sitting like that clock up there, the one that Ronnie Wood's painted. You know, that's, you know, you'd thought any watch which is capable of being accurate to 2 or 3 seconds a day would have to sit on the mantelpiece and not be touched. Yet we're bashing things around. We're cycling, we're swimming, we're climbing mountains, we're windsurfing, we're doing all these things with these watches. And it's still telling the time accurately. So that's what's special about mechanical.
Let's talk about 20, 30 years in the future. Do you think more and more people would be wearing smart watches and higher-end brands might be embracing them in their product lines?
I'm sure. I mean, you've seen a lot in the last 3 or 4 years. You've seen the a handful of more mechanical Swiss watch brands go into the smart watch arena. The hard thing for me is you suddenly becomes a technology gambit, doesn't it? You're competing with the Apples, the Garmins, the Sintos, who are very, very skilled at what they do. And it's a completely different industry. So you're invariably buying that technology from someone else. I mean, you'll see more. I think these things will do more and more exciting things, and it'll be something different. It might be that you wear your mechanical watch 95% of the time, but when you're off training or you're, you know, trying to walk the dog and see how far you can get your heart rate up, you might be wearing something else. So, I mean, it's hard to tell where 30 years' time, but I think there's always going to be a place for mechanical watches because of their longevity. There's not a single part on this watch you cannot change, and so it's going to be around in 200 years' time.
So I'm always really inspired by that moment when successful people started their thing.
Yeah.
Do you remember the time when you sat down or you thought, I'm going to start a watch brand? Was there like a da-da-da-da moment? Yeah, that's my Old Spice impression. Terrible.
Ours was slightly longer. So our father was an incredible guy. He was, it really started with him. He was an aeronautical engineer from Cambridge. So as kids, we spent the whole time in the workshop with him making things. So restoring our bikes, planes. We still fly old planes we built with him, cars.
Yeah.
Restored those sort of things, but clocks are one of his passions, and it was about tinkering. So in terms of, and he loved his mechanical watches, and you know, you take a gearbox apart and you're looking at cogs and gears and pinions and all this sort of stuff. It's not any different on a mechanical watch or a clock. And our mother used to get these old wall clocks and things and bring them from an auction and see if Giles and I could make them work again, which invariably we never did. But it kept us quiet for many hours. But it was that sort of passion for clocks. So very early on, and Dad would talk about the passion for watchmaking and in the UK. And so there's always the love. In terms of starting a watch brand, I think, you know, I think if you were 50, if you go back 15 years ago, if you talked to anyone back then about Giles and I going in and setting up a watch company when it's the marketplace is littered with
it's like setting up an insurance company. Well, you're going against really mature, long-standing.
I know. It's a very
you're
busy,
crazy.
It's a busy, but, and we had that a lot. You know, you're just mad.
Did that inspire you?
I think the best thing we never did was go to Basel before we started. And Basel, you'll find 600 or 700 Swiss watch brands.
Yes.
So that was great. So ignorance was bliss on that front. But also, I think we felt there's definitely a niche in the market for a company or a brand which wasn't based around fashion. We felt a lot of watches were becoming more fashion orientated and just slightly, we had a passion for vintage watches. We loved that vintage side of things.
Yeah.
And a lot of brands were going away from that. They're, funnily enough, they're coming back now.
They are, yeah.
But that was something which we did felt there was a sort of niche in the market. I think you're sort of, when you're young, we had this, Giles and I both had this sort of life-changing incident in 95 when I was in a plane crash with my father. I smashed myself up. I broke 30-odd bones. Giles was, our father died in it. Giles was just about to take off in another, pressing for an air display in another aircraft.
Were you flying it at the time?
I was flying it.
Yeah.
And when you have something like that combined with a kind of, I keep using that word, but passion for something like watches, sometimes the sort of tipping point happens. You think, actually, sod it, let's just go for it. Mm. And I don't know, we had very little responsibility then. We didn't have kids.
Yeah.
We did, or Giles had just had twins, actually, having said that. Yeah, that's true. He just had twins, but I didn't have any kids. And I think doing it now in this stage of life would be harder, but we just thought, actually, let's give it a go. And we had very understanding wives.
Yeah.
And we started, our initial expectations were very low.
Yeah.
You know, I remember talking to my wife and she said, well, how many watches do you think you're going to sell this year? And I went, I don't know, you know, if there's 50 people out there. I remember saying to her, there's 50 people out there who buy us as opposed to a well-known brand, some of the ones I've mentioned, you know. Yeah. I thought that'd be amazing. Mm. And yeah, we exceeded that, which was fantastic.
Yeah. And do you think you're, to some degree, living the legacy of your father through the brand?
I do. I think he comes up virtually every day in some form.
Which must be amazing.
But great gift. I mean, sadly, he's not around to have a join in. But he, and I think, you know, parents in general, my mother had a lot to play with it because she had allow us to spend all this time in the workshop and allow my father...
That's a good parenting skill, by the way. I like her style.
It is.
Put that together.
It's very
she
clever.
She didn't have TV and all that stuff back then.
No,
or
no,
internet.
He didn't have all these sort of screens and things. So it's a very, very different thing, but it kind of worked. And so you got... we do think every day, and obviously he does come up in the story a fair bit, and you think about him a lot. And, you know, you look at a watch, you go, I remember him... You know, he had a collection of watches, which in hindsight is pretty ropey. You know, none of them particularly amazing, but they all mean something to us. You know, this is the one he was flying with in this particular year. Or this is the one he went diving with us on. You know, that's the lovely thing about watches. They all tell a story. And something quite special about that.
And so you don't have any immediate plans yet for complications or for divers or for... You know, a lot of watches, aren't they, inspired by motor racing? Or are you just
not at all. I mean, we have a few of the relationships of that. Obviously, from the military side, by default, we do a lot of professional diving watches. Mm. So that is a part of us, you know, where there's a lot of the SF side, or, you know, you might have... Royal Navy clearance divers or North Sea diving, rig divers, and we do a lot of that fraternity. On the motor side, we've had a relationship with Jaguar for 8 years.
Right.
So we're the watch partner for them. And Giles and I have a passion for old cars. So
E-Type?
An old E-Type, And Giles and I did this road trip this summer and took a couple of old cars out to America.
Lovely.
And drove through there and seeing retailers. I mean,
and then
clearly it was work.
Yeah,
it was a lot of work.
You fix them yourself when they go wrong, do you?
We did, although my car, the joke was that my car was sort of slightly more American than English by the time it came back, by the time all the clutch master cylinders and brake cylinders and things went. But no, we had a great thing. So we do have a relationship in other parts, and you know, a lot of our ambassadors are doing some incredible things on the... You know, whether it's the professional divers or the explorers, or if you look at, take a Ben Saunders crossing the Antarctic now, he recreated Scott's route in 2012, which is 1,800 miles on foot.
Yeah.
Now he's doing Shackleton's route, which are basically transantarctic. But he has a modified diving watch, which is titanium. It's got special oils in it. It's GMT, so he can navigate using the sun. And, you know, they're designed, they're sort of tool-like watches. And I think that's why they do appeal to the military in quite a... Yeah. Big way.
One thing really strikes me sitting here with you is you're like, the passion that comes through. It's like, I feel like I'm getting a history of your life in this boutique.
Sorry about that.
No, you shouldn't be. I think it's really inspiring. And I think one of the challenges entrepreneurs have when they're starting or pivoting or whatever is passion profession. You know, you're like, maybe you've got this passion. Like, you want to be a watchmaker, but all the odds are against you. Or maybe, you know, you should do something that's a bit more of a proven profession. You've turned your passion into your profession. What would you say to people starting out? Should they really go for passion, or should they make sure there's a market there? Do you have any...
You've got to make sure the product's there to begin with, which is why it took us 5 years. So you can have the greatest passion in the world, but if your product's a bit dodgy, you're not going to get far. Mm. But you can work on that. That's possible. Everyone can get a nice product in the end if you're willing to put the time, energy, investment in that. Once you've got that, and if you, have the right reason for doing it as well, So, you know, what is the purpose of the brand? And that's there, so the story effectively. And then you've got ladles and oodles of passion. Then you've got a very, very good chance of making something work because it's yours. There's so much energy you can put into it. And if you think about most of the, for example, the watch fraternity, most of the competition we have is big luxury groups. So they'll be, whilst they're producing a beautiful product, it's a very different organisational structure to us. We can do things perhaps they can't, it is fascinating. And so we could be slightly rebellious and disruptive is the word you used earlier on, just because you're allowed to or you can.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. You didn't say the name of the big watch group.
Well, no, there's a number, you know. Yeah. There's the Richemont, you know, most of the, you know, watches. If you took a percentage of, you know, probably 80% of the watch brands, most people in the high street know about, so owned by Richemont, LVMH, Swatch Group. Mm. Of course, you've got the biggies like Rolex on the side.
So. Yeah. And what do you think the benefit is for a brand being under a big entity of multiple brands?
I mean, there's a huge amount of shared infrastructure. Yeah, you know, there's shared resource. I mean, component manufacture, distribution, marketing budgets. There's a whole lot. And if you're lucky enough to be in a group, a bit like LVMH, which would be, you know, a number of watch brands, you've also got the whole luggage and the champagne. You've got loads of different areas of business propping you up as well. So. They've got a lot of resource.
And what would the boutiques and the disruptors and the smaller brands say is an advantage of being a smaller brand?
You're forced to innovate.
Yeah. And you can quicker, I guess.
And you can do things quicker. Yeah. So I think that's the benefit there. And you can try things potentially, which often you try things like relationships, partnerships that you don't quite know where the end result's going to come or go to, and we can do that.
Yeah.
Whereas I think with a larger brand, everything's prearranged and focused sort of 12 months beforehand, isn't it?
Sure.
Because you have to, because it's just the way of the world.
Mm. So there are a lot of Pilots watches out there. I mean, I've got some IWC Pilots watches, which I really like. I had the Breitling Emergency when I passed my...
very important, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever pull it?
No, thankfully I never had to pull it out. I mean, if you've got time to pull that out, you're probably not in that bad a shape.
Yeah,
I never got the chance to test that. Although every time you get drunk, it's very tempting, isn't it, to pull that out?
Yeah. I'm sure that's been done a few times.
Yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, there are a lot of great Pilots watches out there.
Yeah.
So what makes Bremont different, unique, and what gives it the clear space that it's sort of forged for itself?
Okay, I think it's coming. One, I think when we started, we weren't... first of all, I suppose we are Pilots, which kind of helps. So we are passionate about watches, but also passionate about aviation. Aviation has been in our blood from day one. Mm. And because of that, we... I guess have an understanding. It's not a marketing thing. It is what we are.
Who you are.
You know, we do a huge amount of flying and all sorts of airplanes, and I think that's part of it. But also, you know, we've worked with some amazing partners over the years. You take Martin Baker. You've probably seen that ejection seat.
That's so tempted to sit in that.
go for it. Pull that thing. But you know, they've saved 7,500 lives today, and it's a British engineering company, second to none. And we share the same principles. We're sharing the same loves, and you look at their engineering, they've never had a seat in that respect fail because it's so beautifully engineered. And that was a relationship which had, you know, definite benefits earlier on and led to certainly a lot of work in the military world. And I think over time, you kind of get the sort of momentum, and we're lucky enough to work with sort of hundreds and hundreds of wonderful sort of, military squadrons around the world now, and you learn a huge amount by working with them.
Yeah.
It's they're incredible ambassadors for us as a brand, and we're something we're immensely proud of. I think when you put all these things together, you end up with a we never have a you never see a Bremont advert with a sort of slightly made up kind of picture with a pilot doing something. It's all reality, or it's all. We just have a very different approach when it comes to the marketing of that watch as well. So,
I'm I like buying limited editions.
I
guess I didn't get enough attention at school and want to be seen as an individual.
No, that's...
And actually, most of mine have appreciated in value quite a lot. And I was having a look at a couple of your pieces before you came in, and I noticed one of them, you put parts of aircraft within the movements and in the rotor.
Yes, yeah.
Tell us about that, because I think that's really cool.
So that, again, out of the watches we make, is a very, very, very small percentage, and it's normally one watch a year. So, and that watch normally has a chanceable angle attached to it. Yeah. And it's a way of doing something slightly different. It's a way of telling an incredible story. Mm. And it's a way of working with some amazing partners. So it may have been Bletchley Park, where we did something with the Codebreaker, original parts of Alan Turing's heart and Enigma machines, or it might be, you know, the 1903 Wright Flyer. Can you imagine wearing a watch with a time capsule in it, with original fabric from the first ever aircraft that ever flew? I mean, it's a bit like, for Giles and I, it's a bit like holding the Turing shroud or something, apart from it's real. You know, it is the most amazing thing to work with. But also there's, or, you know, the 100th anniversary of the Royal Air Force, so working with the RAF Association and on that. And they all have a lovely angle. So if you take, argument, say, the Wright Flyer, we raised hundreds of thousands of dollars to restore the Dayton family home, which is the Wright family home in Ohio. And that was a lovely project. Or, as I said, you know, working with the Royal Navy on taking original parts of HMS Victory. And integrating. And I think when you look at the watch from the front, you would not, you know any different. It's just a fun, pretty watch, hopefully timeless in design. But it's when you turn it over and you see all the sort of secrets that
unfold.
Which is
always the first thing I do on a watch.
Well, it is. Look at the back. And it's suddenly, and there's a huge amount of time, energy, craftsmanship, engineering skill goes into doing that because it's a moving part. And it becomes a really lovely story unto itself, and that's sort of the reason we did it. And it's become, they've become very good investment pieces over the years. So some of the ones we did in 10 years ago are three times the value now.
Right.
And for a brand of our age, that's quite special.
I was going to ask you about that because I can't work out if it's luck, and it often is a lot of luck. I have Pateks and APs, and I always buy the limited ones where I can.
The
prices have gone wild.
Yes.
And I just think, you know, is it just a supply and demand thing? You know, like they only made, 100 of the Schumacher. I think I bought the gold Schumacher, lovely piece, and that's gone up a lot. I bought the Arnold Schwarzenegger limited edition ones, and sometimes I think, well, it's just a supply and demand thing. You know, they don't make many. AP don't increase their volumes too much. And then they get a big ambassador like Michael Schumacher or Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Job done, easy. But then are there other forces at play that are making... Because a lot of watches are appreciating in value. A lot of Rolexes bought these Green Dial Anniversary Submariners for $3,000 and $4,000 a few years ago. They're all $15,000 now.
Yes.
And they produce a lot of them.
Well, no, I don't know if it...
Or, teach me some stuff, you know.
Teach you some stuff. Well, I think limited by... You hit the nail on the head. Limited is limited. Mm. So, for example, ours will only make 300 a year, or so, you know, which is tiny volumes. And it's not a limited edition of 10,000 pieces. Mm. And your immediate... It doesn't matter if... It's the same in the car world, classic car world.
Yeah.
If you're one of 36, whatever it is, or 250 GTOs, that you know... It's going to have a certain intrinsic value.
Yeah.
When you're looking at, but then also, I think it's a great, great comparison. I mean, the classic car world. You look at some of the 911s now; they've gone up and up and up in value. But now they're starting
softening
because they made so many of them.
Yeah.
So there's I love old 911s. They're the best car. I mean, they're brilliant, brilliant, brilliant things. But they did make a lot of them, and the ones that will keep their value and be better investments, the one where, you know, they made 300 of them or 200 or whatever it is. And you've got to be careful. So I think the things that are going to appreciate are the ones where there is something slightly special about them.
Yeah.
The brand is there, but also they did make, in terms of quality of things, they made very few of them. And I think it's going to be the same in the watch market. I think you might see a bit of a bubble. You know, something like the Paul Newman Daytona.
That's crazy.
It is crazy, but that's one of, you know, it's a very special.
Paul Newman Daytona, worn by Paul Newman, the one that went for millions of pounds.
Yeah,
that's one of one, isn't it?
$17 million or something. But it is a very...
I've got a 79 one, so that'll stay in the
Did he wear it?
No, he didn't wear it.
As worn by...
Get a picture of it.
But it becomes something else, doesn't it? It becomes, this is special for, it's so iconic, and Paul Newman's such a obvious dude. But if you're one of, you know, you're one of 20,000 watches because it has a green dial, is that enough to keep it going in the future? I don't know. Possibly not.
Yeah. So you really think it's mostly supply and demand and exclusivity?
I think there's hype with, and I think everyone wants to get on the bandwagon. And I think, and you see, and I'll keep going back to it, but you see in the classic car world the whole time, you know, it's suddenly. You know, there's a number of cars out there which have gone up and up and up in value, but they made a lot of them. Take the 246 Dino. It was one of my favourite cars, but it's, you know, 15 years ago, it's 70 grand. Now they're 350 grand. And you kind of think, you know, they didn't make 200 of them. They made a few thousand of these things. So
there seems to be some kind of backwind.
Yeah.
I've had Ferraris. Like, as I said, no attention at school, so I've got no class like you. I need to get into this British class, but everything's just like, look at me. but like, when I had the first Ferrari I bought was a 430 with the H-gate gearbox. That was always my dream car. And in 5 years, we lost no money. I bought it with my business partner. We halved it. In 5 years, we lost no money. And in that time, I thought, I want a Testarossa because I love Testarossas. And they were 40, 45 grand for a good one. And now they're like 170 or something.
They go up.
And it's
will that stay like that?
So I think a bubble.
I think they'll soften, they'll come down a bit. I mean, this is my view. And it's the same with, you look at, you know, 911Ss or something. You know, they they've gone down a bit now. And it's because everyone thought 911S is that's the next RS.
It's lasted a long time though, hasn't it? I mean, this has been happening, I feel like, for about 7 years.
No, well, certainly the last, four or five, it's gone up a lot.
It doesn't seem to be stopping.
But then you
need Bitcoin.
Well, this is the thing, and stick to what you know, understand. I think that's the other thing. I think if with all these investment decisions, if you stick to what you understand, you've researched, you probably have a proper... love of as well, and I think you'll do okay. But
so the one question I get asked a lot, but you know, I almost feel like I should set up some kind of watch brand myself with how often I get asked is, you know, what's the first good watch someone could buy? And a lot of people who follow me, they know I have a bit of an investment eye as well as an eye for passion. And of course, the Daytona is the good starting point for everyone. What's the best watch in the Bremont range to start with, which is a good one? You've got a nice watch and maybe a chance of it holding its value.
We're quite lucky as a brand, or very lucky as a brand, because we talked about supply and demand. That has always been we can't make enough watches. So that's where we're quite lucky. Also, we've been very, very strict on controlling our supply in terms of is very little, if any, actually grey market Bremont, which a lot of brands have suffered with. We didn't suddenly pull out of China or have a nightmare distributor problem out there because we just don't have distributors. We always deal direct with retailers. So that's made it easy. I mean, in terms of, again, following on from what we've just said, you know, we've got a watch coming out with Ben Saunders. It's going to be called, it's based on his first expedition, and then it's a sort of follow-up to that, which was the Terra Nova was his first one. That was a limited edition of 300 units, and they've gone up, and they're in demand, and that's a pretty nice entry price point, relatively speaking, compared to our other limited editions. There's a few limiteds we do sometimes which are accessible, and you know you're not going to lose them, and they normally go up. So those sort of things are nice.
Mm. Do you find that, because years ago when I was buying watches, gold used to be quite soft in price, and used to drop a lot. But I'm really into gold watches again because I didn't get enough attention as a kid. Hey, look at my gold. I'll do some therapy. I'll get over that.
Yeah. We'll chat about it afterwards.
Thank you, but gold seems to be quite strong in watches now, price-wise.
Yes. I mean, again...
And you often make... Brands often make less gold watches, don't they?
We don't make a huge amount. We have a... You know, a few in our range, but limiteds tend to be, we do a version of a limited watch.
Yeah.
So this 1918 watch we've just done, there's a white and a
and
a rose gold version.
At,
but there's only 75 of them.
Which is perfect.
So they're so small. So, yeah. But they, you know, they go very, very, very quickly. And again, they hold their value for a number of reasons. And but I think if it's done in a nice way, then I think they can look beautiful.
Yeah. Okay, so penultimate question, then we'll do the quick fire round because I know you've got.
Not at all.
Thanks so far for your time.
Well, absolutely pleasure.
It.
No,
I
real
hang
pleasure.
Out here all day.
No, you can.
Thank you. Right, so I started my business and had family involved, and I get a lot of followers saying, "Oh, you know, what's it like working with family? Should I borrow money from family?" Or you have worked a lot with family, obviously.
Yes,
your brothers, you know. You co-founded Bremont together. So what's it like working with family? What are the upsides and downsides? And he's
Giles,
not here, so you can say whatever you want.
Giles isn't here, is he? Well, he's an amazing photocopier, office cleaner. Do you know...
The yin to your yang.
Yeah, exactly. No. The nice thing about Giles and working with Giles, you know, he could be sitting here and he'll be answering exactly the same questions, and we're very, very similar in that respect. Mm. Yet we're different enough to complement each other. And I think... when you're setting up a business, having someone the trust is implicit is a huge benefit. You know, of course you would, as your family. But you're not going into the unknown by yourself.
Yeah.
You've got someone you can bounce questions and
I found off. That so important.
Isn't it? But
you can feel very alone, can't you?
You can feel very alone. But I can say to Giles, and we've both been through, you know, I smashed myself up, you know, however many years ago. Giles broke his back in 3 or 4 places 3 or 4 years ago in an airplane crash and the engine failed. You know, we've both been there and life for both of us is very short.
And well, you've done very well to survive because most people don't survive those crashes.
You haven't seen Giles. He looks a bit odd.
He
looks a bit odd.
Does he?
but you know, you can sit next to him and go, "Giles, should we do this?" You go, "Yeah, why not? Let's do it." And I think if you're by yourself and you're having the same question or the same thought process, you probably wouldn't do it. But I think you'd be more risk averse.
Yeah.
But when there's both of you going, "What the hell, let's do this. Let's buy that piece of machinery," which is God knows how much, many, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds, so you can finish a case or a movement part in the UK, you go, "Yeah, let's do it."
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, perhaps if by yourself, you probably think, actually, let's wait. Yeah. So that sort of thing is really, really useful. And you know, he's got a great mind, and we work together in well like that. So it's great.
And has it helped you through harder times knowing you've got a partner there?
Oh God, yeah.
That's been the biggest benefit.
And you know what it's like. There are hard times. It's not plain sailing. There's ups and downs. And what's nice about working with someone, again, if the trust is there, you when you're up, they might not be as up. Yeah. And, you know, it goes a bit like this, doesn't it? You can pick each other up when you're down. It's like, come on, we can do this. And whereas if, again, but you're by yourself or I think you have to be a certain personality. And I think, obviously, there are people out there who can do it by themselves, but I don't think I'm one of them. Mm. I really enjoy it, the fact you can. It's better to... it depends on your motives as well. You know, ours isn't... It's about something... it's about building something, and it's about building something which you can both enjoy together as well. And we chat about, obviously, our father a lot and the whole family influence, and it's nice, actually. It's something quite special to share it with someone.
I would just like to stress that point because I think a lot of people don't go into partnerships because they think they're giving away half of something. I think that they don't realise what you gain having a partner. Mark and I, my business partner, have had so much good times, so many laughs. When things have been hard or we've had bad PR or critics or whatever, we can just laugh it off in our office between ourselves, saying things you can never say on camera. Just having a laugh, just, you know, like supporting
each other.
I don't know, I just really get that sense from you that you have that fun. And
well, you have to, life is bloody short, I was saying, and you've got to make it sure it's fun. And if you don't, and actually that was one of my... I've already worked out my New Year's resolution 2018, but it's right up the top is make sure there's a lot of fun involved because I think the years zoom past. Mm. You look at your kids and suddenly they're on the next school year and everything else zooms past as well. And you're, every minute's got to be as enjoyable as possible.
Mm. Did your life change in any way with kids? I mean, when my kids were born, I actually really did start flying a lot less, and I got scared because all of a sudden, I'd never felt it before, but there's some of these people that I feel this such strong need to protect, and also my wife, don't fly, don't fly, don't fly.
I really,
fly.
Yeah,
she hates it. She hates it. I mean, you know, rotary wing, there's always a story, isn't there? Like motorbikes,
well,
there's
always a story. Unfortunately, I do all that this stuff as well, like motorbikes. I think...
Poor wife.
I think she knew what she was getting into. Tiny bit. But also, it does change. I mean, I don't do nearly the number of air shows, for example, used to. And that's quite a dangerous pastime. And... when you're opening up the throttle on a motorcycle, you don't do it in the same way. And your mindset does change. Mm. The most precious things you have are your family, and you don't ever want to blow that in terms of not being around for them. So, it does. It does. And I think it's a good leveler, isn't it, having family?
Yeah, I think so. And I definitely started to take less risks in business as well once I had kids. It's biological of some degree. It wasn't a conscious thing for me.
Because exactly. You've got to make sure there's something there for them in the future. Yeah, it is. It's fun. This is why, if you can set up when you're in your 20s, do it, because that's when you have more opportunity to do so, don't you? Mm.
All right, should we do the quick fire then?
Let's do it. Tell me what these are.
Okay. All right then. So, your second favourite watch brand.
My second favourite watch brand.
Or watch brands you love.
Yeah, if I had to have a Grail watch, it would be sort of original Graham pocket watch or something from all those years ago. But I love a lot of the vintage watches. So if you look at the old Mark 10, 11 IWCs or some of the old vintage Explorers on the Rolex side.
I bought my wife a vintage 50s Rolex Explorer.
You can't go wrong. They're so timeless. They're beautiful. And they're very non-showy. They're just nice things. So I do like those.
Yeah. All right. Great. Your favourite non-Bremont pilot watch?
Oh, non-Bremont. I like some of the German ones, actually. Mm. You know, the old, some of the Glashütte brands. Yeah. I think they're very, very pretty. I think there's understated engineering involved there. And again, they're not very ostentatious. Mm. And I think a pilot's watch has to be... The clarity has to be there.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be able to look at a watch quickly, and it's sort of fairly non-fussy. And funny enough, a lot of the German brands.
Mm. Okay, great. Any famous or successful people where your watch is that would be good to shout out to them?
There's a few fun pictures on our website. So we were lucky. There's a lot of fun, interesting people wear them. Yeah. Which we're very, very fortunate to have. But it's we don't advertise with people. We don't have a sort of big picture of a guy holding a watch up. And I think they wear them because they like them, which we're very, very lucky with.
Yeah.
But check out the website and you'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll let you give a chance to send everyone where we want to go in a minute.
Look,
it's important. I wanted to do this because I'm a real passionate watch guy, and I think it's great that we've got passionate English brand. I really do.
Thank you very much.
We used to have so much in Britain, didn't we? And then we sold it all. And it's great that we're like, you talk about Jaguar. Well, that was British everything, and it all got sold.
But if you look, even if you take a Jaguar, okay, the parent company is not British, but all of the IP in terms of the people, they are Brits. Keeping that company going. Ian Callum, one of the most incredible designers, automotive designers in the last 50 years. Mm. You know, he came from Aston Martin, designed the DB7 and the 9, the Vanquish, all those sort of cars before he went to Jaguar. They're Brits.
Yeah.
The engineering skill set we have in this country is phenomenal.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, we're just rubbish marketeers. So that's the problem.
Yeah, yeah, we're too reserved and polite. Yeah, aren't
we? Tiny bit.
Yeah. After you, Ferrari.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, great. So something that's done quite a lot in the watch and the car industry, actually, is the aftermarket adaptations. So, you know, there's often the black coatings put on the watch,
there,
or sort of their, I won't mention some of the brands.
Bamford's.
Yeah.
George is a great guy.
So what do you think about that?
I think there's a place.
Pimping them out.
Do you know, Value-wise, I don't really know what impact it has, because it's a bit like, again, going back to the car world, you know, if you have an original car and you mess it around, it becomes something else. It becomes a bit of an outlaw, doesn't it? And I think, at the end of the day, if you're wearing it, you've got to separate investment from whether you like wearing it. And if you do want to change something, it's up to you. We don't change things for people, really, because you can't, because where do you start and stop? But you know, I don't think there's any right or wrong. I think if you love it...
I'm going to push you on this one. You're very diplomatic, which I love, but I'm going to have to ask it. Sacrilege or an expression of individuality? Which one of those are you going to choose for blacking out your watch?
Individuality.
There you go. All right, great. And then finally, what does the word disruptive mean to you? Does it have any connotations, or what would you put the meaning of it as? This podcast is called The Disruptive Entrepreneur.
Yes. Well, disruptive, it could take both ways, couldn't it? It can be, I like to take the meaning of it being, I suppose, more innovative and more fresh than, I guess, and more different. And I think, you know, I think... in terms of Bremel, I think we have been slightly disruptive, especially in terms of you know, our mission in terms of bringing stuff back to the UK. Slightly different approach to it than a British approach, as opposed to, you know, some of our foreign competitors. But but that's not a bad thing, I don't think.
Nick, thank you very much.
Rob, absolute pleasure. No, really lovely chatting. I could chat for hours.
Oh, actually, likewise, so. But we can't. Where should people go if they want to find out more about Bremont, the brands, if they want to invest in a piece?
Well, go and look at, obviously, bremont.com, bremont.com. But you've also, you know, social media now, there's some amazing stuff on. So, for example, Bremont Military, Facebook, for example, you'll see thousands and thousands of amazing photographs of people doing amazing things.
Do you have an Instagram account we can follow?
Most people I do. I'm at Bremel Nick. And there's normally fairly safe stuff. You learn, don't you, for not. Not being too risky, but no, please do.
All right.
But thanks again, Rob. Really lovely
thanks,
to
Nick.
You.